This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Death and English class go together often, and yes, you're welcome to insert any joke about your English test scores right here. The fact is, when studying English, you encounter death from the very first time you pick up Shakespeare. But how often are students encouraged to write about their own experiences with death?
Anytime a teacher encourages a student to open up and write about grief, there are landmines everywhere.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from the author of Death Education in the Writing Classroom. We'll also spend an academic minute exploring death and a host of other events that can cause grief. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Jeffrey Berman's new book, Death Education in the Writing Classroom, is a collection of raw nerves. Dr. Berman is a distinguished teaching professor of English at the University at Albany in New York. In his book, he shows how college students can write safely about dying, death, and bereavement. The book is based on an undergraduate course on love and loss that Berman taught at the University at Albany. Dr. Berman spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Ian Pickus.
It's always fun to have some light reading from you, I have to say. Let's talk about how you came to this project and how you got your students on board and how that trust builds in a classroom.
This is my 39th year teaching. I can hardly think of any place I would rather be than in the classroom. For many decades, I've been teaching personal writing classes and encouraging my students to write about their lives, about their conflicts. My first book about teaching was published in 1994. It was called Diaries to an English Professor. And that was a turning point for me because that was the moment when I really stopped writing mainly about literature and began writing about my students' lives. And so I was so interested in writing Diaries to an English Professor that I've continued doing that. In 1999, I published a book called Surviving Literary Suicide. 2 years later, it followed with Risky Writing. Then I published a book called Empathic Teaching. And then I co-authored with a former graduate student of mine a book on cutting called Cutting and the Pedagogy of Self-Disclosure. So I've been writing books about teaching for many years. When my first wife, Barbara, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, I was shocked, as everybody in my family was. After she died, I wrote a book about her life and our life together from her diagnosis to her death called Dying to Teach. My courses on love and loss are intense. They're emotionally charged. But I think my students would agree there are many more smiles than there are tears. And now I also write books about loss and love. A few years ago, I fell in love with a lovely woman named Julie. June, we were married. I'm so grateful for being with her, for having joy in my life again. And I know that my present students are happy to hear that. So I write about love and loss and recovery. I write about resilience. But my books are less about me than about my students. And it's a revelation to see what students are willing to acknowledge in a classroom that's based on empathy. I teach a course on love and loss nearly every semester. It's perhaps the only course of its kind in the country. And I tell my students at the beginning of the semester that I will not be grading them on the content of their writings, nor will I grade them on the degree of self-disclosure. Rather, I grade them only on the quality of their writing. But I should put the word only in quotation marks because most students are average writers. Many are poor writers. And so a major part of the course focuses on improving their writing. And in effect, what I'm doing is helping my students express themselves on the most important issues in their lives. And just to give you one example, I haven't read or heard anybody make this observation, but most grandparents die when their grandchildren are in college. In many cases, since about 50% of first marriages end in divorce and 60% of second marriages end in divorce, in many cases, when a grandparent dies, it's a double loss, losing not only a grandparent, but a parent surrogate who helped to raise the student. And so every semester, my students write about either a grandparent who is close to death or a grandparent who's just died. So that's what students do in the course. And their classmates' self-disclosing writings embolden them to self-disclose in ways that they hadn't anticipated. All of the research on self-disclosure indicates that self-disclosure begets self-disclosure, so that one student's self-disclosure becomes a kind of gift to his or her classmates. After a month or so, students are opening up in ways that they had never anticipated, and they learn so much from their classmates. What they learned from me is how to improve their writing, but what they learned from their classmates is how peers have gone through experiences that they themselves are going through, but which they thought nobody else could understand.
There's not too much in the book that's genuinely funny, to say the least, but there is. I read the passage of Nico, who was a graduate assistant in that time. I actually remember him.
Yeah,
teaching your course, and he found himself just basically doing a Jeff Berman, or as he refers to, the Bermanator impression. Why is it that the style of class you're teaching is so rare?
Well, it's unfortunate that what you're saying is true. There are very, very few people, very few educators in the country who are teaching the kind of writing courses that I'm teaching. I have to acknowledge that this is considered by most educators in the field to be risky teaching. Anytime a teacher encourages a student to open up and write about grief, there are landmines everywhere. Clearly, this is risky writing, it's risky teaching, it's risky learning. Risky in the sense that people are writing about their emotions as well as writing about their thoughts, and they're opening up and disclosing feelings of sadness, of depression, of anxiety, sometimes of despair, that they are afraid to reveal in other courses because they're afraid that they will be judged and criticized and attacked, if not by their teacher, then by their classmates. So in order to encourage the kind of writing that I'm encouraging, a teacher has to create a genuinely empathic classroom. What that means is nobody will criticize anybody else's writings. We're not looking for critique. We're not looking for, well, do you agree or disagree with this point of view? We're not looking for any kind of criticism at all, except criticism of the student's writings. I ask my students, just listen. Try to wear your classmate's shoes or be in your classmate's skin, and just listen to what that person is saying. And once you suspend normal judgment, once you give up the idea of critiquing or attacking another person, then you're helping to create an empathic, trusting classroom where people are willing to acknowledge feelings that they are afraid often to express to their best friend.
Still to come, more of Ian's conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Berman about his book, Death Education in the Writing Classroom. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the Best of Our Knowledge, number 1134. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Berman, Distinguished Teaching Professor at the University at Albany. He's speaking with the Best of Our Knowledge's Ian Pickus about his latest book, Death Education in the Writing Classroom.
You've mentioned self-disclosure begets more self-disclosure. Does self-disclosing writing, in your experience, make the writing stronger to begin with, in that there's so much invested in these essays?
Yes. Instead of asking my students to write about their summer vacation, I ask them to write about being depressed on their summer vacation, and that immediately changes the nature of the writing. I try to choose topics that encourage them to write about their own lives. For example, try to bring back to life verbally a person who is no longer here. Try to imagine what it was like for your grandparent before his or her spouse died. Try to write essays about the most important issues in your life, and don't be worried that I'm going to criticize you, because I'm not. You can write about whatever you wish to write about. The only comments that I'm going to make will be to improve the quality of your writing. So if you write with your heart as well as with your head, with your emotions as well as with your thoughts, you're writing with a much greater sense of involvement. And if you're writing on a topic that's important to you, you're going to want to do justice to it.
Tell me about the idea of death and life existence that comes up in your book.
Well, we're always living with death, and we're always responding to the deaths of loved ones. Now, when most students are in their early 20s, their experience with death may be the loss of a beloved grandparent. But surprisingly, a large number of students have lost a parent. Some have lost siblings. So death surrounds us. We can't escape death. Somebody estimated that on television and in the movies, we're confronted with thousands of deaths, but they're not real deaths. In our life, we are confronted with real death, and here's an opportunity to write about what remains the most forbidden subject of all to talk and write about. People are so spooked by death that they don't even use the word death. For example, most of my students do not use the word die or death with respect to a grandparent. They'll say, my grandfather passed. And I'll say, you know, it's perfectly fine for you to use the word pass. Most people use that word. There are advantages and disadvantages of using the word pass. I use the word die and death. And so I'll talk about my first wife's death, not my first wife's passing. And I'll say, I'm not going to tell you which word to use, but you should know the advantages and disadvantages. The word pass is softer. It's euphemistic. Many people consider it more respectful. On the other hand, I prefer the word die or death because of its power and its honesty. Surprisingly, most people don't know this, but all of the statistics indicate that 1 out of 4 American high school students seriously think about committing suicide in any particular year. 1 out of 10 college students seriously think about committing suicide in any particular year. And so that means if I'm teaching a class of 30 students, there are 2 or 3 of them who are seriously suicidal, and 6 of them who had been suicidal in high school. Here is an opportunity to write about something that hardly anybody has an opportunity to write about. And it becomes eye-opening for classmates to hear about how close some people have come to giving up on life and their resiliency in deciding to live rather than to die. These are eye-opening topics, and I encourage students to write about it. And nobody becomes harmed by writing about it, because even if they begin crying in class as a result of reading their essay, they know nobody's going to criticize them for crying. And in fact, if somebody begins to cry while reading an emotionally charged essay, more than likely that some of their classmates will well up with tears. This happens more than once during the semester. And so I'm always having students say to me, I've been taught that one should not cry. I've been taught that it's really a sign of weakness, a sign of cowardice. But really, crying in the classroom is a sign of being moved deeply, literally, to tears. And my educational philosophy is simple. If it's appropriate to laugh and to smile over something that's funny or joyous in the classroom, shouldn't it also be appropriate to cry or to well up with tears over something that's sorrowful? And then I ask my students, how many of you think that there is as much sorrow in life as there is joy? And everybody's hand goes up. And the people who don't raise their hands generally say to me, I think that there's more sorrow in life than joy.
Those are the Woody Allen fans.
Right. So I give my students an opportunity to write about their joy in the form of love and to write about their sorrow in the form of loss. And I myself am a demonstration that one can have a broken heart as a result of the death of one's soulmate and continue to live and to find life meaningful and joyful. So I don't bring a lifetime of baggage of sorrow into the classroom. I bring my sense of joy, I bring my curiosity, I bring my passion for teaching, and this passion is reciprocated in my students, and their passion heightens my passion, and my passion heightens their passion. That's the beauty of teaching and learning.
How do you avoid these students undergoing a re-trauma? We're dealing with people who've gone through abortions and cutting and suicidal thoughts, and now they're putting it on paper. Do you run the risk of that coming back? You say that it hasn't been a problem, but I mean, talk about risk.
First of all, that's a great question. Second of all, yes, this is a major concern. And when educators have criticized my style of teaching, this issue takes the forefront. There is always the fear that in writing about a traumatic experience, one is re-traumatized in the process. So first of all, I have to acknowledge, yes, this is a problem. But then I have to say, over the years, I've developed protocols to minimize this possibility. You can't eliminate it completely, but you can minimize it. One way to minimize it is not to pressure students into self-disclosures that they don't want to make. And so I don't grade on content, and I don't grade on the degree of self-disclosure. I say to my students, if and when you're ready to write about a wrenching experience, then here's the opportunity that you have. Writing is a slow process. So they're not talking stories that they haven't thought about before. They're going home and spending hours and hours thinking about, let's say, a past suicide attempt, thinking about how they want to express this, thinking about, do I want to express this? Thinking about, have I tried to remain as controlled of the subject as possible? And then they come to class with their essay. What often happens is that an essay that might not have been that difficult to write becomes much more difficult to read aloud. When you read aloud an essay, it changes the nature of the essay. Perhaps it makes it more real because you can't take back your words because there are 30 people in the classroom who have heard it. But the worst thing that can happen is that somebody will begin crying and they'll stop crying and finish reading the essay, or they'll ask me or a classmate to finish the essay. That's the worst that has ever happened in any of my classrooms. Students, hardly ever is it wailing. It's tearing up. It's one's voice cracking. But then getting through the reading or having a classmate finish the essay and then feeling grateful for the conversation, feeling grateful that classmates and teachers are pointing to sentences that are powerful and that are well articulated. And so, yes, I'm aware of this potential landmine, but there are ways around it. And there have been no explosions. If there have been explosions, if there have been re-traumatizations, trust me, long ago I would have stopped teaching this way. The last thing I want to do is to be responsible for another person's grief or to feel like I have harmed another person. My goal is to do no harm. What most educators don't realize is that there is a burning desire on the part of many or most students to write about these experiences in a non-judgmental, empathic way. And almost without exception, students tell me, well, it was painful to write that. It was even more painful to read it aloud, but I'm so glad I wrote that. And I'm so glad I read that aloud, and I feel like a burden has been lifted.
Dr. Jeffrey Berman is Distinguished Teaching Professor at the University at Albany, New York. His book is called Death Education in the Writing Classroom. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Ian Pickus. Death is only one event that can cause feelings of grief. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. We generally associate grief with the loss of a loved one. But as Donna Burns, a professor of educational psychology at the College of St. Rose, explains, grief comes in many forms and should be responded to in the same manner.
Grief and loss are familiar, well-worn terms most often associated with death. Yet it's important to recognize and acknowledge grievable, non-death-related losses. When an individual grieves a loss that is not death-related, it is referred to as a non-finite loss. Non-finite losses include, but are not limited to, potentially life-altering events such as loss of health, disability, divorce, unemployment, or havoc wrought by natural disasters. These types of losses may elicit grief reactions that parallel and sometimes exceed responses typically associated with the death of a loved one. Surprising? Consider the persistent and enduring nature of non-finite losses. These can be very protracted and often trigger secondary or additional losses experienced as a consequence of the primary loss. For example, divorce, a primary loss, may set the stage for subsequent or secondary losses such as financial hardship, custody issues, and diminished self-worth. Non-finite losses can also be disenfranchising. In the midst of coping with a loss that is not death-related, non-finite grievers may experience feelings of detachment and isolation due to a lack of social support. This occurs when an event is not recognized as a grievable loss and the individual is not acknowledged as a griever. Everyone grieves losses, whether finite or non-finite. So to ease the journey, acknowledge and grieve the loss, seek out nurturing relationships with supportive family members and friends, monitor and maintain physical, emotional, and spiritual health, engage in healthy activities that bring enjoyment, and if persistently overwhelmed, seek help from qualified professionals.
That was Donna Burns from the College of St. Rose. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.